in this context. I talked a lot about local cage invariant operators. And just to finish, I want to mention one very important type of non-local operator, which is the Wilson loop. So you've seen this before, so I'll be very brief. But let me just mention it, because there's an interesting exercise that you can do, in case you're interested. So the way this is defined is by choosing, first of all, a contour gamma in the gauge theory. And then this Wilson loop operator is defined as the trace of the path-ordered exponential of the integral of the gauge field. Remember, this is a non-abelian gauge field. You integrate it over the contour, and you path order it. This is the analog of the time ordering. And you take the trace of that. And this is the Wilson loop operator, which of course depends on the choice of path. So the reason why this is a non-local operator is because this does not depend on the value of the fields at a single point. Okay? It depends on the value of the gauge field all over the path. That's why it's called non-local. There's one particular type of path that's very interesting in the context of applications to QCD, which is the case in which you choose this path to be the following. You choose it to be a rectangle where this side goes along time. So this length is t, which you send to infinity. And this separation here, which is space-like, you call it L. And the reason this is interesting is because you can think of it as the path that you obtain if you take a quark-antiquark in the vacuum. You create them at a given point. You separate them at distance L, let them evolve in time, and annihilate them again. Okay? That way of thinking about this suggests, which is in fact something true that you can check, that for this type of contour, the expectation value of the Wilson loop in Euclidean signature, this is given by e to the minus t, which is going to infinity, times v of L, where this v is the energy of a quark-antiquark pair separated at distance L in the gauge theory. So this v, you should think of as the energy of a quark-antiquark pair separated at distance L. So if somebody tells you how to calculate this object, then by looking at the behavior for large t, you can just read off the coefficient in the exponential as a function of the distance, and that tells you the quark-antiquark potential. So in QCD, this has a linear dependence in L. This v grows linearly with the distance. In a non-confining theory, this is not true. And with a little bit of information that I'll give you just now, you can actually compute this in n equals 4 super young Mills at strong coupling using ABS-CFT. So I'm not going to do that, but let me tell you how you compute this type of operators using ABS-CFT at strong coupling. The idea is that the gauge theory lives at the boundary of anti de Sitter space, and you're choosing a contour here. This is gamma. So this expectation value of this Wilson loop is given by the surface of the minimal surface, minimal area surface, sigma, that has gamma as its boundary. So the prescription in the classical approximation, when g squared n is large and n is large, when you can use classical string theory and classical supergravity, all you have to do is, if somebody gives you a contour, find what is the surface with a minimum area that ends at the boundary exactly on this contour. Okay? So the boundary of sigma is gamma. And then the expectation value of the Wilson loop of gamma is simply given approximately in this classical approximation by e to the minus s of sigma, where this is just the area of this surface. Okay, the string action, as you know, is just the area of the worksheet. Yes.
Isn't the minimum area just
no? No. If this space here was flat space, then yes, of course, the minimum area would be this surface all the way up at the boundary. But this is curved. Okay, the metric is this one here. And you can actually convince yourself. So in this metric, there is a gravitational potential pulling down, so to speak. If you let a particle go from here, it will fall down. And the same is true when you try to minimize the area. You will see that there is a competition between wanting to be near the boundary to minimize what you think would be the area and the gravitational pull. So in this particular case, this loop here is very simple. It looks something like this, okay, where this is T. And this is L. So finding this minimum area surface boils down to finding a minimum length curve. Because in this case, by symmetry, when you send T to infinity, you know that this sigma is going to look like this. Is this clear? So if you know how to solve for the minimum length curve that goes down and up and is connected at the boundary at two points separated by a distance L, then the minimum area surface is just that curve translated over the time direction. Yes? This is by symmetry, because in the limit in which t goes to infinity, this loop has translation symmetry approximately along this direction. So the minimum area surface must have that property too. So if you do this calculation, which is, this is really computing the, it's like solving for a catenary. Okay, if you hold a rope at two fixed points, then it will hang down along some curve to minimize the energy. Yes?
So this is just because the metric is constant.
Yes, the metric, you have translation invariance along the gauge theory directions. Okay, so doing this calculation, I strongly suggest that you do this calculation. This is one of the exercises. What you will be computing is the quark-anti-quark potential at strong coupling in a theory that you have no idea how to compute it any other way. And you're computing it via a classical calculation. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
How accurate is the calculation?
How what?
How accurate? Do you have any idea how accurate an answer it gives you?
Yes, it gives you the exact answer here in the limit in which the tooth coupling goes to infinity and NC goes to infinity. In other words, the result that you obtain has corrections. So you get some V of L. And the exact V is this plus corrections that go like 1 over root lambda or 1 over MC. Yes, because in the limit lambda and MC going to infinity, the description on the gravity side reduces to classical gravity or classical gravity plus classical strings. These corrections, for example, come from if you go away from the infinite lambda limit, then this surface you're looking at can fluctuate. You should integrate, do a path integral of the surfaces with the boundary condition that they all end at this loop. Any more questions? Excellent, very good. So then I'm going to move on to the next lecture, in which hopefully we'll make contact with experiments. So everything I've said so far is for a theory that at least the vacuum of this theory doesn't look much like the vacuum of QCD. Okay? So let me tell you why it's still useful. So, n equals 4 super young Mills is a theory that whose vacuum doesn't look very much like the vacuum of QCD. Why? Because, so let's say this is n equals 4, and this is QCD. If you look at the ground state of the two theories, n equals 4 is not a confining theory, whereas QCD is a confining theory. Okay, so in the vacuum, the degrees of freedom are halfings, are color singlets, which are always bound together. Here, there's no confinement. Secondly, this is a highly supersymmetric theory, which QCD is not. QCD has no supersymmetry, et cetera, et cetera. This one is a conformal theory. Okay, it has no scales. QCD is determined by a single scale, lambda QCD, the dynamically generated confining scale. Okay, so the ground state, or if you like, the physics of the two theories at low energies, don't look very similar. So you can ask yourself, what is this useful for? Okay. However, now suppose that you consider these two theories at finite temperature. Okay, you put the theory in a box and you heat it up. Okay, heat it means you put a bunch of gluons and quarks, or hadrons if you like, in a box and you heat it up. This theory, at a temperature that we will call T, the confinement, which is approximately 175 MeV, undergoes a crossover. Okay, it's not a real phase transition, but it's a very sharp crossover, and I'll have more to say about this later. For the moment, all you need to know is that below you have a confining phase, but at this temperature you have almost a thermal phase transition into a new phase, okay, above this temperature, that's called the quark gluon plasma phase. Deconfined or quark gluon plasma phase. It's called quark gluon plasma because down here, as I said, all the degrees of freedom are color singlets. They are confined. Up here, the degrees of freedom, the relevant physical degrees of freedom become again quarks and gluons because they are not confined anymore. This is because the one way to think about that is to realize that above this temperature, the thermal fluctuations are so violent that these quarks and antiquarks and gluons are no longer bound together. Okay? Now, suppose that I also now introduce a temperature. I consider now n equals 4 in a box at finite temperature. Once you introduce finite temperature, that breaks conformal invariance because now you have a scale, okay, the temperature. Just like here, you also have a scale, which is the temperature. You also break completely all the supersymmetries. Temperature breaks supersymmetry, and let me not elaborate. Well, one way to see that is that, you know, supersymmetry has to do with the fact if you have supersymmetry, then there's an exact degeneracy between bosons and fermions. Okay? for each boson, there's another fermion, and vice versa, with exactly the same mass and the same, well, roughly, essentially with the same mass. Okay? Once you introduce the temperature, you can actually show by doing calculations that this degeneracy is broken. Okay? And therefore, that tells you that all the supersymmetries are broken. Is that clear? You're looking at the theory in a phase in which you're breaking explicitly the supersymmetry by adding temperature. So if you look at the theories at finite temperature, in particular above this temperature, neither of them is conformal anymore, neither of them is supersymmetric anymore, and neither of them is confining anymore. Okay, so all the properties that make this phase down here so different from n equals 4 change when you go above this temperature, and in fact the theories start looking much more similar. Of course, there are still differences, but this suggests that there is a hope that using this, just a second, using this theory at finite temperature as a model, as a toy model for QCD in the deconfined quark gluon plasma phase, has some hope being a good thing to do. Okay?
Yeah, so by finite temperature, do we mean that that the imaginary time is periodic, or do we mean that there's like a bunch of particles and they have kinetic energy or something?
What I mean is that the object that what finite temperature, what this means, you can study it in imaginary time formalism or in real time formalism, but what it really means is that your observables are thermal averages. Okay? That, for example, the vacuum expectation value of an the expectation value of an operator, right, is given by the trace of e to the minus beta h times on. Okay? What is this doing? This is saying that you have to sum over all states in the theory with a weight given by e to the beta is one of the different ways. Given by the energy divided by the temperature. Compute the expectation value in each of those states and sum with this weight over all possible states. Okay? So finite temperature means that you have a classical probability of being in any state with any energy, where that classical probability is e to the minus the energy over the temperature. Okay? And then you still have to compute the quantum expectation value in each of those states.
And the H is the Hamiltonian
of the theory?
Of the theory? Like
yes.
From the Lagrangian?
Yes. This is the Hamiltonian of your system. Yeah. Okay, so you don't really need to know much about finite temperature quantum field theory to follow what I'm going to say. Everything is going to be very physical and very intuitive. Okay? Of course, if you want to do, I mean, there's a whole technical world behind finite temperature field theory, but we don't need that. Yes?
Why, in general, do we always use the Boltzmann distribution for quantum physics?
Why do we what?
Why do we always use the Boltzmann distribution for quantum physics?
Probability.
Yeah.
Well, because you can show that the probability of occupation of a given state is e to the minus e divided by t. So what you do is you first say that there's a classical probability of being in any quantum state, and then in any quantum state you still have to compute quantum probabilities, and then you average. Okay, so before I move on, let me say that one of the motivations for doing this is that studying QCD is something very difficult. You can do it on the lattice. You can put QCD on a lattice and use computers to perform the path integral and try to compute things. And that works well for computing certain observables. But for computing some other observables, it's actually really, really hard to do it on the lattice. Whereas here, we will see that it's almost trivial computing those observables. Okay, this is the power of the correspondence, that in some regimes, it is the only non-perturbative tool that you have to compute certain observables, not directly in QCD, but at least in a theory that you think might have something to do with QCD in this regime. Okay?
So
yeah.
Here, we just given a link to the high temperature part of equals 4.
Say that again, sorry?
Going to link the high temperature part, like so my high temperature n equals 4 with the deconfined part of QCD.
Yes.
But is there any way to then go lower and make options to the confined
Okay, yes. So let me say two things. First of all, here saying high or low temperature doesn't mean anything because T is the only scale. In QCD, high or low means compared to lambda QCD. Okay? Here, if you start with a theory that has no scales and you add one, you might just as well set it to one if you want. So what I mean is that finite temperature, whatever the temperature is here, should be a good toy model for a certain range of temperatures here. Okay? And the second thing is whether you can actually go down in temperature and model the confining phase. That is something you can do, but not directly with this theory. But tomorrow, I'll tell you how to do that. In a slightly, you have to complicate the story slightly to be able to model this phase. And in fact, I'll give you an example tomorrow of a theory that's not QCD, but it's a gauge theory for which we know the gravity dual that has this type of phase transition. And we will see what this corresponds to in the gravity description. There will be a thermal phase transition in gravity that corresponds to this. But that's for tomorrow. OK? Very good. So any more questions? So the first task that we have is, OK, I told you what the space where string theory lives if you want to describe zero temperature n equals 4 sub n meters. But the first thing I have to do is tell you, if I have finite temperature here, how do I have to modify this bucket? OK? And the answer turns out to be extremely simple. The new background, let me write it down and then motivate why this is the correct thing to do. So the new metric is almost exactly the same, except for the presence of this function f multiplying dt squared here, and which also enters here, where f is 1 minus r naught to the 4th divided by r to the 4th, where r naught is a constant. Okay? So, where does this metric come from? Well, remember, this metric here, one way to obtain this metric is to consider D3 brains. Look at the supergravity solution for D3 brains. Remember when we took the decoupling limit? We started with D3 brains, looked at how they gravitate and curved spacetime. And then we took a limit in which we went very near the brains, down the throat. Do you all remember this? Yes? That we did for so-called extremal D3 brains. These are D3 brains that have, we did it for D3 brains that have mass equal to their charge. Okay, so those were supersymmetric D3 brains. And that's why we ended up with a supersymmetric duality. Okay? In order to introduce temperature, you want to introduce energy or mass into the system, but no charge, just energy. Okay? So you might suspect that what you have to do is to look at non-extremal D3 brains. These are D3 brains that have a horizon around them. They are black. They are the analog of a black hole. OK? Does this sound outlandish to all of you? Yes? OK. In that case, don't worry about it. If you want, I'm happy to discuss it later. But if I go into explaining this now, it's going to take me a long time. OK? So for the purpose of the next 30 minutes or so, all you have to believe me is that this is the correct solution to describe finite temperature super Young meals. And I will now not prove it, but give you some checks that this makes sense. OK? Some intuition. OK. So if you look at this solution, you see that now, here, we could go all the way down to r equals 0. But now, f vanishes before we get there, because f vanishes when r is equal to r naught. Yes? So GTP, before went to 0 at r equals 0, now it goes to 0 at r equals r naught. So now here, the horizon has moved to a finite r. OK? In this solution. By the way, I forgot to say that there's also the sphere here, which doesn't get modified. Okay, so for the rest of the lectures, I'll always be dropping this bit because it will play normal. Okay. Very good. Now you see that if you go, so this F modifies the geometry down here, but as soon as you go far away to R greater than R naught, this F goes to 1 again, and the geometry up here is not modified significantly, or the modification goes to 0 as you move to the ultraviolet. Does everybody see this? Yes or no, we'll do. Yes? OK, is this what you would expect? Yes or no? And why? Well, it is what I would expect. Why? Because I told you that moving in the radial direction corresponds to going to high or low energies in the cage theory. Do you still remember this? OK. So if I started with a theory that was conformal, and I introduce a scale, then of course the physics around that scale changes, because before I had no scale and now I have a scale. But if I go to energies way, way, way above that scale, okay, then I might just as well set that scale to 0, because at very high energies I'm not sensitive to the fact. Okay, at the Planck scale I'm not sensitive to the fact that the U quark has a mass. Okay. In other words, the physics will only depend on the energy at which I'm testing the theory divided by the scale that I introduced. This is the only dimensionless quantity. Okay? So if I go to very high energies, it's like going to T equals 0. Therefore, the ultraviolet in the geometry should not be affected by the fact that I introduced temperature, as it is not, because when I go to large R, this goes to 0, and I recover the same asymptotic that I had before. Okay. And finally, there's one more reason, one very strong reason, why you should identify this solution with a finite temperature theory. And that is that you probably all know that once you have a horizon with a finite area, well, there is a caveat to what I'm going to say. But let me be a little not completely precise. Once you have a horizon like this with non-zero Hawking temperature, you know horizons, black brains or black holes actually have a temperature. Okay? This will behave like a thermal system, like any horizon does. You can associate to it an entropy density, an energy density, etc., etc. Okay? So once the gravity description becomes a thermodynamic system, because you have a horizon with a finite Hawking temperature, Hawking, you should also expect that if this is equivalent to some gauge theory, the gauge theory had better also be at finite temperature, because you have to be able to associate to it the same thermodynamic quantities. Is this clear? So in fact, you should have expected that introducing finite temperature here corresponds to introducing a black hole, or a black brain more precisely, over here. Okay? And moreover, you should identify the Hawking temperature with the temperature in the CFD. Yes? OK. How do we compute this temperature? Well, the simplest way to do it, which I believe you have seen before, is to go to Euclidean signature. To go to Euclidean signature in this metric, and then periodically identify the Euclidean time in the appropriate period to make the Euclidean geometry smooth. Okay? So if you go to, if you do p going to I tau, then you see that this bit of the metric describes, this is a Euclidean time, tau. You see that g tau tau goes to 0 at r equals r naught down here. And you can actually show that in order to avoid a singularity, a conical singularity here, you have to identify tau with a specific theory. Have you all seen this before? If you haven't, then this one of the exercises is doing this. It's very simple. And what you find is that you have to identify tau with tau plus delta tau, where delta tau is given by pi r squared over r naught. Okay, this period is called theta, and this is identified with one over the temperature. Okay, the reason for this identification is that, as you were mentioning before, one way to do finite temperature field theory is to go to imaginary time. Have you all heard this before? And periodically identify it with period one over the temperature. I believe you have heard this statement before. Okay. So if I were doing just gauge theory at finite temperature, what I would do is I would live in these directions only. I would not see the radial direction. Okay, the gauge theory lives in these directions only. And I would just take my Lorentzian time, Euclideanize it, and periodically identify with period one over the temperature. Okay? But it turns out everything is consistent, and it turns out that on the gravity side, you also have to identify the Euclidean. If you go to the Euclidean version of the geometry, you also have to identify the Euclidean time. And in this case, it's forced upon you by the requirement that there is no singularity here. Okay. So now that we have this solution, we're going to do two calculations that are very important, very simple and very important in applications to the quark gluon plasma physics. Are there any questions about this so far? So keep in mind this relationship. So from here you see that R naught is proportional to the temperature. Okay? So when, let me write it explicitly, so R naught is given by T, or if you like, T rather, is given by R naught divided by pi R squared. So you see that when you send R naught to zero, the temperature goes to zero, and you recover the zero temperature solution. And also you see that the position of the horizon goes up as the temperature goes up. Okay. So I just said that once you have a finite temperature horizon, you can associate to it an entropy density, which we will identify with the entropy density in the gauge theory, because the two descriptions should be equivalent. So let's calculate that. Okay? Okay. So the calculation that I'm suggesting is the following. Let's compute the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of this horizon. Okay, that's given by the area divided by 4 times Newton's constant. Have you all seen this formula before? Yeah? Once you know the area of the horizon, in the semi-classical approximation, you immediately know the area by dividing by Newton's constant. Okay? So doing this calculation with this metric is completely trivial. Okay? It's really completely trivial. And I'm not going to do it on the blackboard. There's an exercise where it guides you through the calculation and you can get the result. I'm going to tell you the result and interpret it, and you'll see why it has to be that way. Okay? And then you can convince yourself if you do the exercise. So the result here, by the way, the horizon, if you notice, at least let me say this, is at r equals r naught and at t equal constant. Okay, that's what the horizon in a metric is. You take a constant time slice, and then you look at the place where gtt goes to zero. Okay? So if you do that, we are setting r equals r zero and t equal constant. So what's the topology of the horizon? Can somebody tell me? What do I get in this metric if I set t equal constant and R equals R naught, what type of geometry do I get? Well, from here, I get R free. Okay, I have three non-compact directions. And from here, I get an S5. Right? So the topology of the horizon is R3 cross S5. Is this clear? So this is why this is not a black hole, because a black hole has a compact horizon. It's a black brain, meaning that it's it has some non-compact direction. Okay? Very good. So you have to compute this area, which is infinite, because remember I erased, it's R3 cross S5. So there's an infinite volume factor coming, of course, from the fact that this is infinitely extended. So what I mean by entropy here is entropy density per unit three volume in these directions. Is that clear? Okay? So this turns out to be then, or if you like, let me write it like this. So this is big S, so little s is this divided by V3. So it's this divided by V3. Yes? And that turns out to be pi squared over 2 times nc squared times t cubed. So this we are going to interpret as the energy density per unit volume in the gauge theory. Okay? We've done this calculation on the gravity side because we don't know how to calculate this at strong coupling in the gauge theory. Okay? So you should view this as the entropy in the CFT at finite temperature in the limit in which the tooth coupling is going to infinity. Because I did this calculation using the gravity description, which is only applicable in the limit in which this goes to infinity. All right? Very good. Now, can somebody interpret this result for me? So, of course, this numerical factor, there's no way you could have guessed it. But this dependence on NC and T, is this obvious to you? Okay, let's start with T. What is the dimension of the entropy density? Oh, first of all, what is the dimension of entropy? Dimensionless. Very good. So if I'm looking at dimension at entropy density per unit three volume, what's the dimension?
Energy three.
Energy cube, right? 1/length cube or energy cube. Now, I need something here with dimensions of energy cube. Do I have anything else apart from the temperature? No, because it's a conformal field theory in which the only scale I have introduced is the temperature. Okay? So it has to be proportional to T cubed. Okay? Now, the dependence on NC. If you remember, in the very first lecture, we computed vacuum diagrams in the large NC limit. Do you remember this? And I told you those contribute to the vacuum energy, or at finite temperature to the free energy or the entropy density. And we have to get NC squared because we're looking at a theory whose number of degrees of freedom scales in the large NC limit as NC squared because they are gluons. Do you all remember this? So this dependence and this dependence are obvious. They have to be there. And the only thing we didn't know was this prefactor. Yes?
But why does it have to be actually NC squared? Why can't it be like 1/NC squared?
No, because this, one thing I forgot to say, this is a non-confining theory. This is important. There's no confinement. So the degrees of freedom that are active at a given temperature are always gluons and the rest of the matter. Okay. All the gluons contribute the same. Okay. And there are NC squared of them. So they have to contribute in this way. Now, one thing that's remarkable about this result is that I just told you that this is interpreted as the entropy density, identified with the entropy density in the gauge theory, in the limit in which the coupling constant goes to infinity. Because we did it on the gravity side in the classical approximation. So it's a non-trivial result, the fact that the entropy density has a finite limit when you send the coupling constant to infinity. This is not guaranteed a priori. Okay? Now, from the point of view of the calculation in the gravity, on the gravity side, this t cube comes from this r0. Okay? When you compute the area of the horizon, you will see that it's proportional to r0 cubed. And that's where t cubed comes from. Whereas the dependence on nc comes from the fact that the entropy is area divided by Newton's constant. But if you remember, g Newton's constant goes like gs squared. Do you remember this? And remember that gs goes like 1 over nc. So gs squared was like 1 over nc squared. You can see it from here. Gs is g squared Young Mills. But this is lambda divided by mc. Okay? So this 1 over nc here is what in the end gives you nc squared. The factors of lambda cancel out. Okay? Very good. This is the first calculation. We've just calculated a thermodynamic quantity, the entropy density. Now we need to calculate one more quantity, and then we'll make contact with the experiment. And this is going to be a hydrodynamic quantity. Let me tell you what this is. Okay, what is thermodynamics? Thermodynamics is the theory that describes a system in perfect thermal equilibrium. Yes? But now you can look at a system that's in almost perfect thermal equilibrium and perturb it slightly, okay, with low energy perturbations. Then you have a description that's called hydrodynamics that captures the long wavelength, low energy effective dynamics of these perturbations very near equilibrium. Is this clear? This is what hydrodynamics is. Okay? So in hydrodynamics, what you have is a temperature that depends on the point, a pressure that depends on the point, etc. And you assume that these quantities vary slowly as you move from one point to another. This is what hydrodynamics is, or fluid dynamics, if you like. Okay? Very good. So this, as I said, is an effective theory. Okay? That's valid at long wavelengths. And as any effective theory, it is characterized by a few coefficients, effective coefficients, that enter the effective Lagrangian, that you can calculate if you know the microscopic theory. Okay? One of these coefficients, and this can be diffusion constants, transport coefficients, etc. The one that we're going to be interested in is called shear viscosity. So let me remind you what this is. You have all seen this, I'm sure, in some undergrad course in fluid dynamics. Okay? This is a diffusion coefficient for momentum. So suppose that you have a flow of a fluid. Where you have a gradient of velocities. Okay? So you have a certain momentum, p, in the y direction, this is y, which is not constant in the x direction. What's going to happen? What's going to happen is that momentum will want to be transferred from up here down here. It will diffuse. Yes? So this py, the momentum density in the y direction, is measured by the 0y component of the energy momentum tensor. Is this clear to everybody? Okay, T0i is the momentum density in the I direction. Okay? So if this has a non-zero gradient in the x direction, that will induce a flow of py momentum in the x direction. This charge, conserved charge, will flow in this. There will be diffusion in this direction. Okay. So this is py. Now, what component of the energy momentum tensor measures diffusion of y momentum in the x direction? Txy. Okay. So if this gradient is not too large, okay, in the approximation in which gradients are small, which is the hydrodynamic approximation, this flow is proportional to the gradient. Okay, the bigger the difference between one layer and the next, the more momentum wants to flow. So this coefficient that appears here is called the shear viscosity. And it measures how effectively or efficiently is momentum transferred in a given direction. Is this clear? You've all seen this before. Very good. So just one word of caution about this shear viscosity. I have a question. Do you think that the shear viscosity of a gas, air, for example, is bigger or smaller than the shear viscosity of water? Smaller. Say again?
Smaller.
Who goes for smaller? Okay. Who goes for bigger? Who goes for I don't care? Okay, the answer is that air has a much bigger viscosity than water.
But that's the kinematic viscosity. It means air divided by the density.
Okay, very good. That's a very good point. Let me be a little sloppy, okay? Because what I want to caution you about is the following thing. You're very correct, and I will come to this. But the intuition is the following. The reason why a gas has a larger viscosity or viscosity to something ratio is because a gas is a weakly coupled system. Okay, particles don't interact very much compared to how particles interact in water. Okay, so if you have a weakly coupled system, that means that a given particle here has a long mean free path before it interacts with anybody else. So if this particle has a slight momentum off the y direction, it will travel a long time before it actually feels and it interacts with another particle and scatters. And that means that momentum is very efficiently transferred from one layer to another. Okay? However, if the system is very strongly coupled, then this will very soon interact with somebody else here. And so the momentum transfer is less efficient. Okay? And therefore, the viscosity is smaller. Yes? Is this clear? Very good. I'm saying this because it's a little counterintuitive in the beginning, but it's relevant for what I have to say. Now, what we want is to compute this shear viscosity for that theory, for a collection of n equals 4 super Young Mills particles at finite temperature. Okay? And then I'll tell you what this has to do with QCD. So how would we compute this viscosity? Well, it turns out that all you have to do is to compute a two-point function. And I told you this morning that if you know how to compute, that computing two-point functions is doing classical calculations on the gravity side. OK. So there is a formula that you can show in quantum field theory at finite temperature that tells you that it's called the Kubo formula. And it tells you how to obtain the shear viscosity if you know how to calculate things in the microscopic theory. So this is given by the zero frequency limit of minus 1 over omega times the imaginary part of a two-point function, the retarded two-point function, at zero spatial momentum, where this g, g mu nu lambda rho, retarded of omega and q, this is given by the Fourier transform Don't worry, these details are not important. I just want to point out a few things. This is the important bit. OK. The point is the following. If you know how to compute the two-point function in your microscopic theory of two energy momentum tensors, remember we talked about this morning, if somebody tells you how to do this calculation at strong coupling, then you take the Fourier transform, okay, take the xy, xy component here, set the momentum to 0, and then take the imaginary part, divide by omega, and take the limit omega going to 0. Okay? That gives you the shear viscosity. And this is called Kubo formula. And the reason I'm writing it down is so that you see that once you know how to calculate this, you immediately know the shear viscosity. Why is this formula plausible? I'm not going to prove it, but why is it plausible? Well, because you see, you're computing a two-point function of the energy momentum tensor. What is this? This is measuring the response at the point x of a perturbation, a momentum perturbation, at the point x equals 0. Okay? So clearly it has to do with momentum transfer. Also, you're taking q equals 0 and the frequency to 0. Why is this? Because hydrodynamics is the long wavelength approximation, remember? So these transport coefficients have to do with long distance properties. And the reason you take the imaginary part is because the imaginary part of correlators have information about diffusion. Okay? I'm saying all of this to make this look plausible, because I'm not going to prove it. But the point is that if we want to calculate this shear viscosity in n equals 4, we have to do a calculation of the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor, which I'm not going to do. I'll tell you the result. But let me tell you how you would do it. Okay? Is it clear so far? The philosophy? Okay. So remember that I told you this morning that this is an operator in the gauge theory. What is the field here that is dual to the energy momentum tensor? The graviton. Okay, the metric. So this is dual to a G mu nu. So if I want to compute the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor, what I have to do is to take two functional derivatives with respect to the graviton of the supergravity action . This will give me this correlator. Then I go through all this procedure, and eventually I get eta. OK? This is very schematic, but the point I want to convey is that calculating this at strong coupling reduces to a classical calculation that involves solving Einstein equations, classical Einstein equations in this geometry. OK? So if you do this calculation, you get the following. You get that eta is given by pi divided by 8 times nc squared times t cubed. Again, the t dependence is because this has dimensions of energy cubed, and this is the only dimensionful quantity we have. Nc squared is related to the fact that you have nc squared degrees of freedom contributing, and this coefficient is what is non-trivial. Okay? And now let me make the following remark. This number, not this one, sorry. Now let's consider, coming back to your point, the quantity that is really that really enters the hydrodynamic equations is not really eta separately, but the ratio eta divided by the entropy density. Why? Because this is a measure of the viscosity per degree of freedom. if you like. You can think of it that way. This is related to what you were saying, that it's eta divided by the density. Okay? In a relativistic theory, what enters is the entropy density. Okay? So let's take this ratio. Remember I told you what I wrote down what S was, and now I just wrote down what eta is. So if you take the ratio, you see that this is 1 over 4 pi. Okay. This seemingly innocent result is very, very important, as I'll tell you in a second. First of all, it's important because this ratio, even though I told you how you would compute it for this theory, for n equals 4, which is a very specific case, happens to be the same for every single theory that has a gravity dual in the limit lambda going to infinity and nc going to infinity. Okay, this includes a very broad class of theories. And they all have, as long as they have a string dual, they all have the same ratio in this limit. So it's a universal result. This is the name, the slogan for this result. This is not true for other transport coefficients. It's only true for this ratio. So this is special. And secondly, this ratio turns out to be very, very small. For example, if you look at this ratio for water, okay, you get that it's 380 times 1 over 4 pi. Okay, so it's between 2 and 3 orders of magnitude bigger for water. And water, after all, is the liquid that gave name to hydrodynamics. Okay?
Yes, sir. How do you calculate the entropy density of water?
Well, you can estimate it with a model. Or you can measure thermodynamic quantities and from that, like the energy, et cetera, specific heat, so on, and from that get the entropy density using thermodynamics. Okay? If you compute it for liquid helium, okay, eta over S is actually almost 10 times 1 over 4 pi. And in fact, if you look at any substance in nature, any substance in nature has eta over S at least, well, with caveats, but within experimental precision, at least of order 1 over 4 pi, never smaller. Okay? So this is a really, really tiny number. And it turns out, in fact, if you compute eta over S at weak coupling using usual perturbative quantum field theory, this goes like 1 over the coupling squared. Okay, so this result is valid when lambda goes to infinity. Why? Because, again, we calculated it using the string description, the gravity description. If you do it at weak coupling, this is what you get. So you see, at weak coupling, this is very large. As I told you, weakly coupled systems like gases or any weakly coupled system have large viscosities, or more precisely, large ratios of eta to S. Okay? Very good. So I'm going to skip a couple of things and just tell you what this has to do with QCD. And I'm running. No, I'm running. Am I 5 minutes of the time or?
When did it stop?
Yeah, okay. Okay, so let me just finish and tell you what this has to do with QCD. Okay. So I told you. I told you that QCD, let me plot here T over T deconfinement. I told you that QCD at a certain temperature has almost a phase transition. It's really a crossover, but it's a very sharp crossover from a confining phase to a deconfined phase. So if you calculate the energy density in QCD, which you can do on the lattice, okay? On a computer, you can calculate the energy density because it's a static thermodynamic quantity. If you calculate that, you get something that looks like this. Okay? At the deconfinement temperature here, This is one. Okay, I'm plotting T over T de confinement. And this is the energy density divided by T to the fourth. You get a very sharp rise in the energy density. Why? If this was a first order phase transition, this would be a discontinuity. Okay? Because it's a crossover, it's actually continuous but very sharp. Why is this happening? Because the moment you deconfine, you go from a phase where the only degrees of freedom contributing to the energy are hadrons, for example, a baryon or a meson. And suddenly, all of these guys break up, and all the quarks and gluons contribute individually then to the energy density. So the number of degrees of freedom increases very quickly when you go through this crossover. Is that clear? That's the intuition. You sort of liberate degrees of freedom, and then they contribute independently to the energy density, as opposed to contributing in groups. OK. Now, up here, if you normalize this so that 1 corresponds to the result for a free gas of quarks and gluons, then this is 0.8. What I'm saying is that as soon as you deconfine, the energy density is 80% of the energy density of a completely free gas of quarks and gluons with no interaction whatsoever amongst them. Okay? The reason I'm saying this is because this conclusion, or this observation, I should say, led a part of the community to the following interpretation. They said, well, as soon as we go at T slightly above T deconfinement, the energy density is almost that of a free gas of quarks and gluons. It's only corrected by 20%. So this suggests that already at this temperature, the interactions between quarks and gluons are very weak, okay? Because after all, the energy density is almost that of a free gas. Is this clear, this logic? Because it's wrong, okay? But this was the logic. Any questions about that? No? Okay, so I'll tell you. But first I want you to understand the logic, because otherwise you won't see the point. Okay. Very good. So this suggested that the quark-gluon plasma at temperatures already just above this temperature should be weakly coupled. Okay? If this were true, then eta over s would be of order 1 of the coupling squared. Because I told you, at weak coupling, you can calculate it perturbatively. And this would be very large, okay? Because at weak coupling, 1 over lambda squared is large. Yes? Okay. Now, there are a few reasons why you should not believe this logic. Okay. First of all, it is, of course, true that if you go to temperatures asymptotically high, then because QCD is asymptotically free, at very high energies, at those very high temperatures, it is true that this has to become weakly coupled. However, there is no reason why that should be true all the way down to the deconfinement temperature. Moreover, this is a theory that as soon as you go below T deconfinement, confines. So why, meaning it becomes strongly coupled? So why should you expect that as soon as you go above, it immediately becomes weakly coupled? Asymptotically, it will, but not necessarily over here. Okay. And finally, one more reason, is that if you plot all the thermodynamic quantities, say the pressure, for example, again, divided by the appropriate normalization, they don't have such a sharp rise and a plateau here. What they do is something like this. OK? So they don't attain a value close to the free value until temperatures, maybe or 4 or 5 times T deconfinement. Not immediately. Okay? So if you were to look at that, you wouldn't say that this suggests that it's immediately weakly coupled. Okay? Very good. And finally, let me say that the fact that a given thermodynamic quantity is close or not to the free value is very misleading, and you cannot conclude from that what the value of the coupling constant is. And we know a counterexample to this type of logic, which is n equals 4 super young meals. Why? Why do we know that? Because something I forgot to tell you. Which is, let me tell you why. In n equals 4, I told you that the entropy density, we computed it at lambda going to infinity. Yes? Using the black hole solution. It turns out that this result is 75% of the result for the free theory, which is valid at lambda equals 0. Okay? So what I'm saying is, n equals 4 super young meals is a theory where the free result at zero coupling and the result at infinite coupling are the same up to a 25% difference. Yes? So if I tell you what the entropy density is, and I tell you it's 75% of the free result, you cannot conclude that I'm at weak coupling. I could be at infinite coupling. Okay. So here, if somebody tells you, look, the energy density is 80% of the free result, you cannot conclude from that that at that temperature, the theory is weakly coupled. OK? Very good. So to conclude, then, I told you, if you believe this logic, then eta over s should be very large. The question is it? And the answer is no. OK? How do we know this? Well, in QCD, we cannot compute eta over s directly by any method. But we can do an experiment. We can measure it. How do we measure it? What people do is they take two very heavy ions, okay, like gold or lead with lots of nucleons. And they make them collide at very high energies, huge energies. In fact, at LHC, the energy of this collision will be as high as the very high energies that LHC is designed to run in order to discover the Higgs and so on. OK, so they make them collide. And then part of them just fly over each other. But part of them collide, and what they form is a region in which a fraction of this huge kinetic energy gets transformed into heat. Okay? You smash two things together with lots of degrees of freedom, and they heat up. Okay? So here, you reach temperatures at the relativistic heavy ion collider in Brookhaven that are as high as 2 times T deconfinement. So what you're creating here is a tiny drop of quark gluon plasma. Is this clear? This tiny drop, it's extremely hot, and it expands. And as it expands, it cools down. And when the temperature drops again below T deconfinement, it confines again. And what you measure in the detectors is pions and other mesons and baryons and confined states. But you can, by measuring those, you can reconstruct, roughly speaking, what happened here, and convince yourself that you reach a temperature above the deconfinement temperature. So you're creating a new form of matter, the quark gluon plasma, and you can study some of its properties. And in particular, you can see that in order to obtain a consistent description, in fact, eta over s is of order 1 over 4 pi for the quark gluon plasma. And this is the reason why, at RIC, for a while, they were giving away these mugs, okay, these cups, that said, RIC serves the perfect liquid. Okay, why? Because a perfect liquid is a liquid that has zero viscosity. Okay, it flows with no dissipation. Okay, so the smaller eta over s, the closer you are to a perfect liquid. And in nature, as I told you, there is no other system except for cold atoms systems which have a ratio close to 1 over 4 pi as well. But there's no other system that has a ratio really smaller than this. So in a way, the quark gluon plasma you generate in these collisions is the most perfect liquid that you can create in nature so far. Okay? Another reason why it's interesting is because in the early universe, the universe was very hot. 1 microsecond after the Big Bang, the temperature was around PV confinement, just above. So it is believed that if you go back in time in the early universe, there was a phase where quarks and gluons were deconfined, and what you had was a huge, well, not huge. I mean, obviously much smaller than today, but the universe was basically a quark gluon plasma ball. Okay? So by doing these collisions at Rigg, you're learning about the early universe in that sense. Okay, let me see if I have something else to say. No, I think that's all, and I'm over time. So are there any questions? Just one thing I want to emphasize. I want to point out that this number came out from a calculation in the simplest example of ABS CFE, which is n equals 4 at finite temperature. Okay? There are many, many examples that are much more complicated that have all the features. But just with that one, it's enough to have a toy model that gives you a number, which, by the way, came as a complete surprise. Okay, when people were looking at these experiments, they didn't expect eta over s to be so small. This was a complete surprise. And this is why there was, and there is still, such a hype about using ABS CFE to learn about QCD. Because these are things that cannot be computed any other way, some of them. You're not computing it for QCD, but you're computing for a theory, an ether, which is more or less similar, or at least similar. But it turns out to be quite close to QCD. OK? Very good. Any questions? OK. So then tomorrow we'll continue.